Mini episode 454 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.info.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge, mini episode number 454 of the program where nothing is off topic. This is FDH managing partner Rick Morris. We have a very special discussion coming your way today. We are talking the playoff races in Major League Baseball, coming down the stretch in Major League Baseball. And additionally, we are going to get into the topic of the new commissioner in baseball, the commissioner-elect, I should say, that, of course, being Rob Manfred. He was elected as next commissioner in Major League Baseball at the recent meetings in Baltimore. We'll be getting into that as well. Helping me conduct today's discussion, one of our FDH Lounge dignitaries, Steve Callis. You can also, of course, hear him occasionally on WFAN in New York, SNY in New York, many other outlets there in the media capital of the world. Very pleased to have him on to help us conduct this discussion today with MLB.com columnist Richard Justice, somebody who has been writing about and covering the game of Major League Baseball for a good long time now, so it's our pleasure to have him on the program. I bring in my fellow cast member, Steve Callis. Steve, how are you doing today, my friend?
It's great to be with you, Rick, and with Richard Justice. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Love talking baseball on this show, as always. And our very special guest for today, who we are pleased to bring onto the show, Richard Justice. Richard, how are you, sir?
I'm good, Rick. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for being here. It's great to be able to have you on and talk baseball with us. And in terms of taking a broad overview of the races this year, as you've written about recently, there are five teams that are really very interesting to look at in what is a year of great parity: the Rays, Yanks, Marlins, Braves, and Reds, all of them on the bubble. And I want to talk about that. But before we get to that, I just want to get your thoughts on, in the year that Bud Selig is leaving us as commissioner, it seems like he's finally getting his fondest dream of the Pete Rozelle 8-8 league, you know, where on any given Sunday, it seems to be applying to Major League Baseball this year. As you pointed out in this column, we're getting some separation. Obviously, you have the Orioles and the A's and the Angels and the Dodgers and some teams that are. We're finally getting to that point. And I guess earlier in the season, you had the Brewers and the Giants, who were sort of the outliers in that regard also. But before we talk about the specifics of it, what do you think is driving the dynamic of this almost unprecedented parity that we've had? I know there's a second wild card, but it clearly has to go structurally way beyond that, you would think.
Well, I think when Bud Selig became commissioner 22 years ago, his first priority was to give every team a chance to win. Now, that's complicated how that happens. Some revenue, some wealth was passed from the rich teams down to the poor teams. And I also think Billy Beane had a huge role in it. The advanced analytics showed teams like the A's and the Rays how they could do things a different way. I think the rules in the draft, I think the fact that teams don't let their best players become free agents anymore. I think it's just been a whole host of things that have allowed it. And I think, frankly, teams have gotten smarter in the draft. Even Brian Cashman of the Yankees says he tells his people draft day is the most important day of the year. And so the point is that if you're a fan in Pittsburgh or you're a fan in Boston, you can look at your team and say, hey, we've got a chance to win on opening day. And if you don't have that in a sport, if the payrolls dictate the standings, and that was probably true 25 years ago, then you got a sport that you've got some trouble. If I think if the season ended today, four of the top five payroll teams would miss the postseason.
I just want to follow up on that with you, Richard, when you're talking about the draft, because that goes to a point that I've been making on the show here, and that I've made to a good friend, Russ Cullen, the proprietor of the Sportsology website, who is a Mets fan and who is impatient a couple of years into the rebuilding there with Sandy Alderson. And I get that on a gut level, but isn't it true in this day and age that again, if you don't have a farm system, and clearly Sandy Alderson inherited next to nothing, and we can sit here and say, well, really, how much have they done since then? But if you don't have a farm system, because like you said, the players are getting locked up with these contracts here, you're not seeing prime guys out on the market for those mega contracts there in their best years. It's almost impossible, is it not? You look at the Yankees and how handcuffed they are. You look at the Mets. They end up throwing money at Curtis Granderson last offseason just because they wanted to feel like they were doing something. Isn't it almost impossible for these teams, until they grow a decent base of young players and cheap players, to really accomplish anything?
It is impossible, and that's true of the Yankees and Red Sox. You look at this great Yankee run. It began because they didn't trade Bernie Williams, and they didn't trade Derek Jeter and Mariano Rivera. They brought those guys up through the system. And if it's true for them, it's more true for the Royals and the Pirates. Yeah, that's where everything begins. You know, and in fact, you can look ahead, like in 2011, we looked at the Royals and said, this is one of the great farm systems ever. And you knew eventually it would pay off, that they would turn a corner. You know, and for a general manager, it's one challenge to build a great farm system. It's a second challenge, probably a different skill set, to build a winning roster. But I agree with you 100%. It all begins with the draft, with the international work that they do. Quick story about Felix Hernandez. When the Mariners did not offer him the most money, I don't believe, at the end of the day. But they had scouts down there that got to know his family, that began basically recruiting the kid from the time he was in the, you know, eighth or ninth grade. And they developed such a trust that Felix Hernandez was a Seattle Mariner long before he was a Seattle Mariner. And that's just good, smart baseball work.
That is very interesting. I'd never heard that before about King Felix and some of the early origins of how he got to be hooked up with that organization. And, Steve, as far as the point that Richard was making about farm systems, that goes to something that we've discussed on the program previously. And about you know, your New York Yankees, some of the issues that they're going to be facing, and that they're coming into the year, they really had such a paper-thin lineup compared to what had been expected of them in years past. It seems almost remarkable that they're above 500 at this point in the season with all the challenges that they've faced. Don't your Yankees, Steve, pretty much exemplify this new baseball as much as anybody, and the challenges of trying to make it all up just on the checkbook?
Well, I think we've seen that happen this year, although I think Joe Girardi has done a good job. I don't know how many teams lost four of their top five starters at the beginning of the year. Having said that, I think you guys both make good points. It's a new world out there. I'd say just in the last 5 or 6 or 7 years, with the analytics becoming, you know, commonplace almost now. I remember writing an article 2 years ago about Madden and the Tampa Bay Rays and their shifting, and how the revolution had been televised for 2 years and nobody was watching. And then you look this year with the shifts at the major league level. I don't want to say it's comical, because it's not. It works no matter what. I'm an old timer, but no matter what the old timers say, you watch the Yankee announcers going, oh, I can't believe that shift. Why are they doing that? And a guy hits a ground ball up the middle that goes through one time, and then the next time there's a guy standing there for a double play. I think that's all now become commonplace. So, yes, I agree with the whole farm system analysis. I don't think it used to be like that. When I just hear the Felix Hernandez story that Richard said, you know, that takes me back to looking at the way the Yankees used to recruit guys 50, 60, 70 years ago, and how they scouted guys and became friends. And you can even go back to the 50s where the I think it was the Giants tried to hide Roberto Clemente so he could play in the outfield with Willie Mays. But in fact, he was discovered by the Pittsburgh Pirates, and that's how he became a Rule 5 back then Pittsburgh Pirate draft pick. So I think the system maybe going to the international players now has been in effect in Major League Baseball. But I think, yeah, it's a very strong thing. And I think the Yankees are proving, much as it hurts me to say this, Rick, I think the Yankees are proving that you just can't buy it, assuming you could buy it before. I think if you look at all the numbers, not just the Yankees, but if you look at all the numbers, a lot of teams with high payrolls in the last 10 years haven't made the playoffs.
Yeah, and Rick, let me add that to what Steve said, is that in the first probably 10 rounds of the draft, maybe 8 rounds, but in there, I I think every team pretty much has an idea of who the players are going to be, who the 300 players are going to be. Now, they may prefer, they may have, you know, scouts that push for one guy over another. But I think after the 10th round, all the things we're talking about, it's still old-time baseball. It's scouts going out and doing their job and believing in guys. You know, the Cardinals got Alan Craig and Matt Carpenter with lower picks. One was a fifth-year guy at TCU. Craig was a fourth-year guy at Berkeley. They'd not even been drafted their junior year. But they had scouts that believed in those guys and trusted them and had seen enough baseball through the years that they had the instinct. Now, there was an analytic component to all of those draft picks like that. I mean, Ed Wade tells the story of Ryan Howard senior year in high school or senior year in college or whatever his draft year was about how teams were fleeing from him, and he had a scout that just said, "I'm telling you, this kid is going to be a big star. Please draft him." And the Astros got a guy named Roy Oswalt because one scout, Dr. James Farrar, drove like 3 hours out of his way to see a JUCO game and looked at this guy at a time when teams wouldn't draft right-handed pitchers under 6 feet tall and took him in the 20th round as a draft and follow. Had they not done that, he would have gotten more than $1 million in the draft the previous year. So I do think for baseball acumen, I do think there's a reward for that. And I do think, in terms of the Yankees, they have worked very hard to do that. I mean, Brian Cashman's told his people, draft day is the most important day of the year. And if we'd had this conversation 18 months ago, they had a ton of guys that they thought were right on the verge. But, you know, young players don't come with guarantees. That we ask scouts to look at a kid at 17 and try to predict what it's going to be at 22. And you know, it's at times cyclical.
Absolutely. That's a very good point. And, again, as far as what Steve was saying, you know, it almost kind of takes you back when he's talking about the Yankees and the old school kind of a thing. That we tend to associate that more so, I guess, with the old days domestically and the superior scouting networks finding and locking down kids before the days of the minor league draft in 1965, when if you had those kind of guys out there, you could kind of blanket the country. But, yes, that's definitely true that it remains a very big component of the game right now, and as you said, particularly past the early couple of rounds. And there are some teams that have had some pretty good prospect yields in recent years that, as your column points out, Richard, they're right now a little bit on the outside looking in. It's been a disappointing year, certainly for the Rays. The Braves, after an excellent start, have kind of given way to gravity. I was kind of questioning how they were holding up as well as they were, as long as they were, but now they're kind of having some issues. You named five teams that are on the bubble that, again, have a lot of work to do to make the postseason. In addition to those two, the Yankees, the Marlins, and the Reds. Out of those five, do you have a particular degree of optimism for anybody?
I don't know. Optimism, I think the Marlins are the most fascinating in that I think what the analytics say now is, I think what Billy Beane's core belief is that you spend on pitching. You accumulate all the pitching you can, and you believe you can platoon here and there and figure it out on the lineup. I think what the Rays believe is defense is vastly undervalued. On the first day of spring training, Joe Maddon looks at his team and it tells his team, "Hey, we got two rules here: run hard to first base and play defense." And when you think about it, you know, it's more complicated than that, but all good baseball flows from there. But what the Marlins did, you know, is when they tore their team up 2 years ago, they just tried to accumulate all the pitching they could. And then over the winter, their new GM, Dan Jennings, thought they had a chance to win, thought they had enough young kids with Yelich and Stanton and Jose Fernandez that they could win. But what he brought in bargain basement veterans like Garrett Jones and Casey McGee from Japan and Jeff Baker. They spent some money on Jared Saltalamacchia. It created a fascinating dynamic in their clubhouse, and even after Fernandez went down, I think they're the team that I'm most interested to watch. I don't know that they've got the best chance. The Marlins are playing awfully well. The Rays probably are on the outside looking in. They might be the best team in baseball right now, certainly the best pitching staff. So it'll be a chaotic September, and, you know, if you love the game, that's a good thing.
Absolutely. There's a lot of chaos going on with those teams. The Rays and the Braves certainly would have been expected to be in the thick of it the whole way going into the season. I'd have to say the Reds also, too. I believe, if I remember correctly, I think I picked them for one of the wild card spots again in the National League. But it's been a lot of chaotic kind of flux going on with these teams. And as you point out with Tampa Bay, how awesome they have been recently, which I guess is to be expected because there's no way they should have had the worst record in baseball for a period of time. What goes down must come up, and they certainly have in a hurry. Steve, based on what Richard was just saying there, any notes that come to your mind as far as these teams that are on the periphery, any of them possibly making a solid run?
Well, I love Tampa Bay, but I don't think they can make a solid run. I think they're the team that got behind in the basketball game 25 points, and they killed themselves to cut the lead to 5 in the fourth quarter, and they just come up short at the end. Having said that, as you know, Rick, you know, my son's been a Tampa Bay fan since Tino Martinez played there, so we watched them through some very poor times. And I do think they have the best manager, the best front office, the best analytics. Again, if you watch them play, and I watch them play a lot, their shifts really work. They've changed the game, literally changed the game on the field in the last 3 or 4 years. I just don't think they're going to get there. I didn't think they were waving the white flag when they traded David Price. I thought they'd get a little more, but I think that's hurt them, even though Cobb shut out Detroit and David Price today, 1-0. I just don't think they're going to get there. I think these standings are pretty much going to stay the way they are. I've been fascinated by Seattle all year, Miami recently. I'm not a big believer. Look, I didn't want the wild card, but once you had one, I always said you had to have two. So now that's good. But we do get into the, when I write about the NFL, I'll call it the MFL, the Mediocre Football League, because everything is geared to 8-8, as you said, Rick. But even the Giants last year at 0-6, oh, we still have a chance for the playoffs. And they actually did have a chance for the playoffs. So I'm not a big fan of that, but I understand the business and the economics today in all of these sports because you have so many other options. You have young people with a short attention span. So you want everybody to be in the mix, and everybody's not in the mix, but virtually, you know, two-thirds of the league is in the mix. And on the one hand, that's exciting. On the other hand, that's mediocre. All these teams we're talking about are at or around 500. And I'll go back to the old days, into the 60s and the 70s, to say, you know, 500 teams just wouldn't really be there, certainly before 69 when they split up into divisions. But even for the most part after that, now this is just the way it is. I kind of think the teams that are up there now are going to be up there now. I think the Angels are going to take a little back. I think they're going to take a little backslide, but I think they're still going to make the playoffs as well.
You would have to think so. I have to say, too, great minds think alike because Richard made a very, very similar point about Tampa Bay in his column. And it's fascinating. It occurs to both of you guys as far as the NBA team getting blown out and how they struggle to get back in it. And I think both of you guys are exactly right about that. And how much it's taken out of Tampa Bay just to claw their way out, you know, just like to get back to 500 and how much that has really just been brutal to get to a point that should have been nothing for them to get to at the beginning of the year. But in terms of a team that there have been a few teams, I think, we can talk about Washington as well subsequently, but a few teams that were kind of a year late on what we expected of them, or at least a lot of us did. Toronto was a flop last year, Washington, but certainly the LA Angels, the way that they came out of the gate last year, they were a disappointment because, again, Pujols and Hamilton have really been big disappointments through the course of the last 2 years collectively, even though Pujols has played well at times and even Hamilton's had flashes. But, Richard, as far as this loss of Garrett Richards, your most recent column indicates that it's not necessarily a death knell to them, but for a team that was really kind of coming together this year and a team that hasn't had the ace performance in the last 2 years that you might have thought they would have gotten out of Jarrett Weaver, Richards has become that guy. And now to take him out of the mix here, that would seem to make it very, very difficult, would it not? Much less the fact that you're now going to have, if they slide back to the wild card spot, which may seem necessary, you probably burn Jarrett Weaver there and don't have him for the short series that follows. So you're right that they may not miss the postseason altogether, but what does this do to their overall chances? How grave do you think it may be?
Well, they, you know, I think what you have is five teams jockeying for four spots, and so somebody's going to get left out of the Royals, the Tigers, the A's, the Angels, and the Mariners, and you could make a case for any of them. I think what the Angels have a little bit of a cushion in terms of going forward, and we'll find out this weekend. I think after they get over the emotional loss of Garrett Richards, they'll figure something out. They've gotten good contributions from Matt Shoemaker. They have a kid at AA named Michael Roth, kind of a soft tossing lefty. Randy Wolf and Wade LeBlanc in AAA. It's not what they wanted. It's a crushing blow, and there's no way around that. But I do think that they still have enough. They cannot have C.J. Wilson struggling. They can't have Jared Weaver being up and down. But I do think – I think the idea that their season ended is not right. I think they still have a chance. They're not the team you would bet on going in the post once October begins because, I mean, they thought Gary Richards could match up with John Lester or Max Scherzer or whoever, and he's not going to be there.
No, that's going to be very, very difficult as far as matching up with other teams' aces and how you basically have to move everybody up the line one spot, and that can, of course, make a big difference in October. What I want to get a sense from both of you guys on is we've looked at some of the marginal teams thus far, some of the teams that are basically the Titans, relatively speaking, record-wise. Again, you have the Angels and the A's in the American League West, looking like both of them would be likely to get in at this point. Baltimore, having pulled away in the American League East. Their Beltway cousins, Washington, as indicated previously, having a great year in the NL East. And the L.A. Dodgers, who have really come on strong 2 years in a row here and really been playing up to the level of what you would expect from the payroll and the commitment that the organization has made. So out of all of these teams, I'll start with you, Richard, a sense of who the real favorites are, the short list of favorites on paper at this point in time.
I'd say keep an eye on the Cardinals, but I think you have to go with Washington. I think we're in an era where it's the teams that's playing the best at the right time. They lead the National League in runs and ERA this month, and they've got a little magic going with the way they've come from behind to win a lot of games. The American League is tougher, because you're looking at Oakland and Detroit dominant rotations, but Baltimore's been awfully good, and no one was going to like their pitching as much as those other two teams, so it's a little bit more of a crapshoot. But I just think Baltimore and Washington are the two best teams right now.
That would be a very, very interesting World Series if it came to that. Not purely because of the geography, but as far as how they would match up to one another, expectations for the teams coming into the season, et cetera. That would be magic if that ended up being the case. Steve, you and I have had a number of discussions over a period of time on the program here. At this particular moment in time, your thoughts on the very short list of favorites to win the World Series at this point?
Yeah, I'm going to go cross-country. I'm going to go Baltimore in the American League and the Dodgers in the National League. I watch Baltimore all the time. I'm a huge Buck Showalter fan. He kind of left a little too early for the Yankees. Everybody knows what he did at Arizona with the Diamondbacks, and he left a little too early there. He's the one manager I hope gets a World Series ring before his career is over, but you'll recall at the end of June, Baltimore was 43-39. Everybody was saying how terrible the AL East is, and I don't agree with that at all, by the way. You don't want to go play Tampa now, whatever their record is. You don't want to play the Yankees. Yankees and Toronto still in the playoffs. You don't even want to play the Red Sox now, in my opinion. But Baltimore, just kind of in the mix at that time, is now 30-13 in July and August, 18-7 their last 25. I think Buck Showalter is a great manager, not a good manager. And I think with the Angels, what happened to the Angels, and I agree that I think they're going to make the playoffs, but that's really based on the fact that they're 7 full games ahead of Detroit for the second wild card right now. The Angels play 34 of the next 35 days. After they play Boston, their next 10 games are 7 with the A's and 3 with the Marlins. I think we're going to find out pretty quickly if they're going to hold up or not. But even if they make the playoffs, I really don't see them as a major threat. Oakland's kind of flattened out. It's really interesting trading Cespedes, and I understand you want to get Lester, and he's the number one, but that's really hurt their offense, at least initially. You take your number four hitter out of a lineup, that's always going to be a tough thing. So I'm leaning strongly towards Baltimore, and again, I've watched them play an awful lot. Out in the National League, though, I kind of like the Dodgers. I picked them to make the World Series before, just to be fair. So Richard will know I picked Tampa Bay to be in the World Series before the season started.
I did too.
Yeah, so I do like the Dodgers. pitching, you know, the name of the game. Kershaw, and my father's rolling in his grave when I say this, but Kershaw has been Koufax-like the last 4 days. I'm old enough to have seen Koufax a number of times when I was a little kid. Nobody went to the Polo Grounds in Shea Stadium to see the Mets in the early, mid-60s. You went to see Koufax or Clemente or Warren Spahn or Willie Mays, and I never thought anybody could be as good as he was in that five-year span, but I got to say, Kershaw, who might win his third Cy Young in 4 years, and with the numbers he has, and everybody forgets, and I'm a Koufax defender to the end as the best pitcher ever, he pitched off the high mound. All these pitchers are pitching off the low mound. I don't think anybody quite understands. I was fortunate enough to pitch in high school and even D1 at NYU in college. The big mound is really, really a difference maker for pitchers. Obviously, they lowered it after 68, and that's why they lowered it. So for Kershaw to do what he's doing in the modern era, for lack of a better term, I think is Koufax-like, and I know that might be blasphemy for some people, but I'm as big a Koufax booster as there is. So I think, and I'm a huge Puig fan as well. Puig should have made the All-Star team last year. I thought that was a joke. If he does something that only Joe DiMaggio had done in the history of baseball, I don't care if it's 100 at-bats. He should have been on the All-Star team. But I think it's the Dodgers. I'm with you, Rick Morris. Washington, I liked them last year. They were nowhere last year, but, of course, they're playing real well this year. But I'll go Baltimore in the American League, and I'll go the Dodgers in the National League in the World Series.
Well, full disclosure, Richard, on our preseason analysis program that we did, I believe that between Steve and myself and our other in-house analyst, Ken Detweiler, I believe all three of us had Tampa Bay coming out the American League.
I had the Rays and the Nationals, so I'm right there with you.
Oh! Hey, great minds think alike once again. I believe that was my combination as well, and I think our other in-house analyst, Ken Detweiler, the Nationals could still make us look good on that one there. That's entirely possible. As far as Steve's pick for the World Series here, we'll have to see. I would like the Dodgers' chances of avenging that sweep in the 1966 World Series if it came to that 48 years ago. I would like to think that they would have a very good chance, not least to which because of Clayton Kershaw, and I would guess an overall talent edge at most positions over Baltimore, but it would be a very, very interesting combination if it came to that, no question about it. There are some really, when you look at that, Richard, when you look at the Dodgers, when you look at the Nationals, when you look at some of these powerhouse teams on paper, it would bring up some very interesting matchup potentialities here. When you're looking at the Orioles, when you're looking at teams that, as you said, have kind of pieced it together more so kind of collectively with the lineup and the way that they have put together their ball clubs. It would be very interesting, would it not, if we ended up getting, a team that looked like a powerhouse on paper in the World Series matched up against one of these catch-as-catch-can units?
Yeah, I think you could probably, maybe the Angels are out of that conversation now, but there are probably eight teams that you could look at and say, I wouldn't be surprised if they won the World Series. And I don't know that we've ever had that many teams we could say that about. I mean, I think we would say it about the Orioles. I don't think the Royals are a big surprise, the Tigers, the A's, the Mariners, the Nationals, I mean, the Cardinals, the Dodgers. I think the Giants would be a surprise. You know, the Brewers have been 120, haven't been out of first place since April 5th. So at some point they get the respect, but because you haven't seen them do it in the postseason, I think there's less faith in them. But it's going to be, I think about the Nationals a lot. They've invested so much to get to this point. They paid the price in terms of losing 100 games. And you get to October and nothing's guaranteed. If you've got to go through Greinke, you've got to go through Kershaw. I mean, you've got to go through, if you have to go through Madison Bumgarner or Lance Lynn, I mean, the pitching at the high end of some of these teams is capable of taking over a series.
No question about it. And, Washington has really paid the price with player development over the last couple of years. I feel obliged to make a hacky Giants joke here since you mentioned them. It's an even year, so of course they're going to win the World Series. But, as you said, though, with that lineup and with some of the issues that they have, they would be, I think, kind of a surprise to go the distance. But again, it was a pretty big surprise. I'd say at least one of the last two times that they did it. So they have a knack for these improbable runs. Definitely want to ask as well, and I'll start with you, Richard, since at the top of the food chain with MLB.com and really anything else MLB associated would be this new commissioner of baseball. A little bit of almost papal politics here as far as when the white smoke was going to come out and how this was going to be decided with baseball's version of the College of Cardinals. But the guy who was thought to be the front runner all along did emerge with the job. What was your sense of the thought process by the owners as they were weighing possibly deviating away from the Bud Selig direction and eventually cementing it in the end?
Well, my first thought is that I started covering the Orioles in 1984, and Bud Selig was an ever-present presence every night that I was at County Stadium. And I've known him and gotten close to him. So to imagine a game without him, it's pretty hard. I remember Lou Wolf sent him an email that said, "You will not retire until I expire." And the game has grown and been transformed in so many ways. And I think what baseball decided was a logical thing, is that this guy who has done so much for us, this guy, Rob Manfred, has been his right-hand guy. He did the labor deals. He did the drug deals. He has been basically in on almost every important decision. And I couldn't really – I had trouble comprehending that anybody else would get the job. And I think the support for him was overwhelming.
Yeah, and in the end, that's what ended up happening, because the other candidates could not sufficiently coalesce and provide a winning alternative
That's a healthy thing, that you get in there, and Rob got grilled by a couple of owners. Are you going to be this? Are you going to be that? Because the game, there's work to do, you know. And I mean, there's an obsession with the pace of game. There are many things, international marketing, and a continuing expansion of social media and all of that. I mean, the game has to continue to innovate. So for owners to be able to quiz him and say, "What's your plan?" and all that, I think that was a good thing, and that was a healthy thing. But I think when they came out of the room, I think they felt that the right guy had gotten the job. And I think they knew also that guy probably had to come within the four walls of baseball. That I never thought it worked with a commissioner from outside baseball. He grew to dislike the owners and the players almost equally. Some of the commissioners I've known were put off by the idea of players and owners fighting over this big pile of cash. But Selig spoke the language of an owner, and he dictated that the owners speak with one voice in labor negotiations, and that had never happened before. And, you know, there's a whole generation of fans now that don't know that between 1975 and 1995, the owners and players did their dangest to try to kill the game every 3 to 5 years. So this is a continuation of what's working.
Well, and you're absolutely right about that, because, again, baseball has more or less had some equilibrium over the last 20 years, because you had the owners up until the abolition of the reserve clause, of course, who basically were able to treat the players like serfs, and then the players refusing to give any way whatsoever back to the owners for the next 20 years or so, and really the difficulties that came from that. But I want to follow up on what you said about Rob Manfred's questioning, because I think Adam Silver would probably say in retrospect that if Donald Sterling didn't exist, he would have liked to have invented him, because you talk about a great way to cement a long-term honeymoon as a new commissioner. And Rob Manfred is, of course, unlikely to get anything that dramatic, but as a chance to establish himself as his own man, to do something, and then probably, again, not outright repudiating Bud Selig in any way. Bud has been his patron through the entire process, so that would seem kind of counterproductive if it were to be too overt. But do you see any possibilities here where we may be, looking at it by next spring and saying, okay, Rob Manfred has started to put his distinctive stamp on things?
Well, I think the clubs are already being queried on what can we do to speed the game up. I think that's front and center. And as far as putting a stamp on it, if somebody has an easy answer for the stadium situations in the Bay Area and in Tampa, I'd like to hear them. You know, everybody said, well, I think I think people thought Selig should have issued a ruling by now. But tell me what that ruling should be. I mean, the Giants say the A's moving to San Jose would have hurt us. And, you know, I don't know to what level, but that's a very complicated thing, and it's been painful. So I think, you know, I do. Does Rob have this overarching agenda that's separate from what Seelig's was? I don't think so.
No, you wouldn't think so. I would guess, like you're saying, it's probably more likely to come in subtle ways. But, Steve, as you and I had discussed off air, something that's starting to get a little bit of traction out in the New York area where you're at, and I had been unaware of this until a few days ago, is the notion that with the 25th anniversary, if you want to call it that, of Pete Rose's banishment from the game, of possibly taking a fresh look at that, and of that being something, maybe even a partial reinstatement to where he would be eligible for the Hall of Fame, if not any actual positions here. Do you have any thoughts, Steve, on what might be likely as far as Rob Manfred taking a fresh look at either that or any other issues?
Well, I agree with Richard in terms of this is the natural progression of things. I don't think in terms of actual baseball decisions there's going to be a whole lot different. I think it would just be kind of furthering what Bud Selig has done over the last few decades. But I analogize the commissioner of baseball to a Supreme Court of the United States justice. They've got their job. They might lose their job eventually as commissioner, a Supreme Court justice can. But if you want to do something different, I think number one on the docket would be at least having Pete Rose eligible to the Hall of Fame. Kostya Kennedy, the Sports Illustrated writer, wrote that book this year. There's some very interesting stuff in there. I'm going to write a huge article for tomorrow at WFAN.com, Rick, on why Pete Rose should be in the Hall of Fame at least now, because it was a travesty when they passed the Pete Rose rule back in 1991 when he was about to become eligible to the Hall of Fame. You know, Shoeless Joe Jackson got Hall of Fame votes in the 30s and 40s. Not a lot, but he was eligible. Nobody really knows that. And then on Monday I'm going to write one why Shoeless Joe Jackson should be in the Hall of Fame. But if Manfred wanted to take a little different tack, because I think it's disgusting what baseball does from a legal side, and Richard may not know I'm an attorney, but from a legal side, even Rob Manfred at the A-Rod arbitration, the way these baseball arbitrations are done, Manfred is up there as part of a three-judge panel. He comes down off the panel to testify on behalf of Major League Baseball, and then he goes back up on the panel to decide. Now, everybody kind of knows it's really a one-judge panel, not a three-judge panel, but things like that, and the whole Pete Rose thing, Bud Selig, you know, they requested of Bud Selig in 1997 that Pete Rose be reinstated, and here we are 17 years later with no decision. I mean, that's like un-American. So I'm a strong believer that Rose should be in the Hall of Fame. He's a bad guy. He's a cheater. I think there's a huge difference. He's a gambler. I mean, there's a huge difference, in my opinion, between betting on your team to win and betting on your team to lose. I don't want to get too off on Pete Rose, although it is 25 years this weekend, Rick. But, yeah, I think that would be an interesting thing, although we all know the commissioners are very reluctant to change decisions of prior commissioners, and that's a problem. But if he wants to do something different, that would be something, at least into the Hall of Fame. I would vote for him to come back on the field as well. And again, Pete Rose is a bad guy. He's a liar. He covered it up for 17 years. But I heard Faye Vincent 5 years ago say if Pete Rose had come clean earlier, that he thought, Faye Vincent thought, that he would be eligible and be in the Hall of Fame. And if that's his belief, I think that's a travesty, because either you're out forever because you gambled or you're not. Not you're out forever because you gambled, but if you apologize early, we'll get you back in. So I think that's a very wrong thing that's happened. And again, I'm a Pete Rose fan as a player. He's a bad guy. He's a creep. He's a whatever. But he should be in the Hall of Fame.
Well, that's such a hot-button subject right there. I have to turn around and ask Richard about that. I know every man, woman, and child in this country has their thoughts on Pete Rose, but as far as if any kind of reappraisal ends up being on the desk of Rob Manfred, what would be your thoughts about that, Richard?
I can't see it happening. I think there was a time when Bud Selig was of a mind to hear Pete out. Pete turned it into a money-making book deal, and Pete knows the history of the game. He knows what gambling did to the game. And if you went to watch the Reds when Pete was the manager, you didn't know if the game was on the up and up. You know, and this idea that he didn't bet against the Reds. Well, if he bet $10,000 one night and $500 the next night, I mean, whether it affected how he used his bullpen, his bench, whatever, there was a perception of that. And Pete knows, you know, as he was going for Ty Cobb's record, he regaled us with stories of Ty Cobb. He understands how Babe Ruth brought the game back and all that. So I think the reason now, I mean, one of his defenses shifted through the years, and I think it's now that he didn't use steroids, and he's a doddering old man now. But I couldn't bring myself to vote for him.
Very interesting. Well, we'll have to see how this plays out as far as whether or not Rob Manfred takes another look at it. I myself have been a little bit suspicious of the notion that he might, just because, again, it would appear to be a repudiation of Bud Selig if he did that. And, again, my guess would be that the chance to prove that he's his own man will probably be in ways more subtle than that. But regardless, as I knew it would be, an excellent, excellent baseball discussion here today. I want to thank you, Steve Callis, for helping me come on here and have this conversation with Richard Justice. And, Richard, thank you so much for being a part of the program here today, sir. Love to have you back on as time goes by and as the stitches of the baseball world keep spinning around. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great to be with both of you. Have a good day.
Awesome. Thank you guys both so much. And thank you again, everybody, for joining us here today for FDA's Lounge Mini Episode number 454.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.